Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon. Hope you're all well. Lovely to see you again. Welcome to this latest lunchtime session with DPP. My name is Ollie Rea. I'm the host for these sessions, and I'm joined this week by my colleague David Holmes. No, Phil, just the two of us. But afternoon, Dave.
Afternoon, Ollie. Afternoon, everybody. I'm back. I wasn't here last week. I understand the session last week was very good. I've not listened to it myself yet. I do intend to. But thank you. Thank you for that last week, Ollie.
No problem. I was very lucky to be joined by two of our rising stars, as you mentioned. I'm sure they'll be back very soon to contribute again. So for those of you who are new to this session, this is an episode of GDPR Radio, which really is just an opportunity for privacy professionals and DPOs alike and all those involved broadly in information governance to come together and just have a bit of a natter, really. Just sort of kick some ideas around, look at what's been in the news, anything of interest we've been working on. You know, just share some knowledge, really, fundamentally. It's a wonderful forum. To that end, these sessions, as we always say, they're not ours, they are yours, more importantly. So please do get involved, comments, questions, queries, concerns, anything at all, either pop them in the chat or do just unmute and dive in, get stuck in. As you know, we have a tremendous propensity to rabbit on. So if you want to get a word in edgeways, you'll have to just butt in, quite frankly. We do like to record these sessions, last point of admin. We do like to record these. There's a privacy notice on screen for you now relating to that. Obviously, any issues at all, just let us know. We'll record these for the purposes of putting them out in the form of a podcast afterwards for those who weren't able to attend or might want to listen back. So I suggest we get stuck in, Dave. News items for the week. I know we've got a couple on the agenda. Is there any you wanted to start with in particular?
There is a big one. I think we spoke about it earlier, but if we just leave that one to one side, and we'll come back to the big one shortly. There's just a couple there's a couple of smaller ones. One which you may have come across, you may have seen, is a recent fine by the ICO of a nuisance call blocker company. I don't know if you've
caught that,
but there's a little bit in irony, isn't it? They were funning around trying to sell services to stop nuisance calls, and in doing so, called nearly 200,000 individuals out on the TPS. And consequently, walked away with the fine from the ICO of £170,000.
I'm genuinely convinced that at this point the ICO don't necessarily chase headlines, but I think they do chase enforcement action that makes for at least funny headlines.
It made me really chuckle, so I kind of wanted to lead with that one really before started going down, because like I say, there is a run that we can talk about for a bit, but I just thought that was a bit of irony in all of that. And I thought it was possibly worth leading with a chuckle to start with. So that's that one. If anybody's got any other comments or queries about that one, then please feel free to jump in. The company itself was called Yes Consumer Solutions Limited. It made around about 188,000 or just over 188,000 calls to numbers that were registered with the TPS between a 12-month period in October 18 to October 19. In that sense, but it was all tinged with a little bit of irony in that one.
Yeah, for sure.
The other one that's I come across recently was reported on the 29th of July, and you may have possibly caught this one. You may have spoke about it last week, possibly not. But it's about a solicitor losing an encrypted USB memory stick full of client information. So I don't know if you'd seen this one or come across this one. We can obviously, there's bits around here about security and what does security mean, and some of the fact that some very simple security measures are often the ones that are missing when you start looking at issues. But this particular storage device contained approximately 1,400 documents that were created over 3.5 years, featuring confidential information about clients and former clients, including details of minors, so I'm assuming they mean children, not people clearing out the pits, and details of criminal convictions and stuff. And that was reported to the Solicitors Regulation Authority. The individual was called Lucy Crossman, and she was on furlough at the time and worked for Walsh Solicitors, according to the article that I'm looking at the moment, where she'd worked between October 16 and April 2021. That's the article continues to basically say that the Solicitors Regulation Authority, so the regulator for solicitors, got involved and taken it on board. There's nothing in the article itself saying about whether the ICO were notified, or whether there's any whether the ICO were informed or otherwise. I'm not quite sure how far that story's kind of raised or has risen with the intention of the ICO there, but it does highlight security issues. It does highlight, should we still be using memory sticks in the current world? We might be. I'm not saying they necessarily don't have their place, but whether we need to understand, or whether we need to view USB sticks in a different light, we maybe do. But in this example, from a solicitor's and a law firm, they weren't. So it highlights that some of the very basic measures that you would have honestly thought wasn't an issue for some still are.
Yeah, for sure. And Andy quite rightly saying that he'd strongly recommend that we all check with our IT departments that they're restricting, or even better, enforcing encryption on any removable media devices. So, yeah, absolutely. It's sort of, I know we want to talk about physical security measures potentially a little bit later, don't we, Dave? Because I think you've got a couple of bits to raise on that. So we'll probably come back to that. But you're right. Sometimes it is baffling that sort of things which you might take for granted almost, and might think were there by default, are missing. It's quite concerning, sure. Even at times.
Sure. And with the remote working, so note the point in about the individual being on furlough. So therefore, she had access to work documents when she was on furlough, which it could be permitted, may not be permitted, on depending on the home working environment and what the home working environment was. But I would have honestly thought under the day and age, it's have memory sticks really got a place in use with most businesses nowadays, with things like 365 remote working, remote logons to systems, whether it's through VPN or otherwise, and so on and so forth, and whether it's actually still now justifiable for information to be on memory sticks to that extent.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting point that I suppose it kind of cuts to the core of one of the issues that I come against quite a lot with my clients when they come to me and say, I'm trying to, you know, enforce some safe information handling techniques within the business, and I'm really struggling because people are still just of that mindset that they send everything over email, and they'll, you know, generate a spreadsheet, a report, whatever it is. They'll fire over a copy to six people in the department. Each one will, you know, annotate it, and then they'll cross-reference it and send it back to one another. So you've just got endless copies of spreadsheets being generated.
And held within the Outlook server.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like, just put it in the SharePoint and all access it from there, or on a shared drive or whatever it is, because your cloud service, because that's going to cut down so much. And how many times have we seen it where then a DSAR is put in, and all of a sudden, when you could be looking at one spreadsheet, you're looking at eight copies of the same one. And all of that feeds into your data sets that you're having to download and export and deal with and, you know, deduplicate. I don't want to get into SaaS too much because I know we're talking about it next week, but, you know, you got to be aware of it. Sorry, Dave, I cut you off.
No, it's fine. So sorry, if you're copying the world into emails and everybody's responding to an email, yes, you're absolutely right about the DSAR point. We'll look at that next week when we start looking at DSARs and FOIA and things. But it's also creating multiple more copies within Outlook. And if your Outlook server was compromised in any way, shape or form, then potentially you're making it far more easy to find something of interest, because it's existing in multiple forms within the Outlook server, as opposed to just being a link or even just a file location in a server, as opposed to the document itself. So are you potentially, by doing that, actually weakening security in a sense, in the fact that you're making information more accessible because it's going to be hanging in a place that's potentially going to be the target of phishing attacks and so on?
Yeah, for sure. Michael raising the point about sort of staff taking paper files home, which is an interesting one, because I mean, I wanted to talk about this a little bit later, but I mean, we may as well get stuck into it now since we're on the topic, which is, I know you recently did an audit, Dave, and without obviously divulging anything relating to the client, you had some concerns around physical security measures. And just to sort of circle back to Michael's point about paper files, I think what has been interesting through a lot of the remote deployment we've seen during the pandemic is just how quickly some of those organizational security measures can go out the window when you're removed from that office environment. Because obviously, you know, you take your laptop home, it's still company property. You're still dealing with your employer's personal data that they're a controller of. You know, the security measures continue to apply. And the number of times we will have seen things like, I don't know, forwarding emails to your personal email address so that you can print it off, and maybe printing off paper files at home and that sort of thing. And you just know how easy it is to then lose paper files. They just go missing. It happens. But that's such a security risk that I don't think you need to take in this day and age. I know some people say, well, I don't like reading things on a screen, so I print it off, and you know, fair enough. But you have to apply a degree of common sense to that, I think. I don't know if you've got any thoughts about that, Dave, but I've seen a lot of issues around it.
Yeah, no, yeah, I've certainly got issues over it as well, quite frankly. And I think some of it's through education training, some of it's through enforcing your acceptable use policy, and some of it's just been really obvious to people. And I don't mean to be, it sounds kind of offensive by saying that, but to be really obvious with people, that actually your organisational policies and procedures, or your acceptable use guides, or your training, data protection training, safe information handling training, and so on, that you may offer to your staff, we should be making it really, really clear and obvious to people that those the measures that we put in place, the policies and procedures, apply to your working environment. They're not bricks and mortar bound. They're not just to apply when you're in the office, shall we say. So if you've got the ability to work on a train because you're going to a conference in London, or you've got the ability to work from home because of COVID conditions, your organisational policies and procedures still apply and should be fit for that purpose, and should be individuals should be aware and fully advised of what that may mean for them when they're out of the office, because the policies don't end when you leave the building.
No, absolutely. I mean, I tell you, one of the best examples over this sort of thing that I've seen is we dealt with a breach quite a while ago, for one of our clients who were a housing provider, but also had a lot of other sort of care facilities built into what they were doing. And the incident effectively related to a member of staff printing out an assessment form that they were using with a potential new tenant, I think, a risk assessment type form. And it contained all sorts of sensitive stuff, you know, things like mental health, things like past convictions, you know, really, really sensitive stuff. And so they printed it off to start filling out, to take it to the assessment with them. And as they're driving to the assessment, pop the file on the roof of the car and then just drive off, forgetting the file on the roof of the car. It gets blown off as they drive away. And you sort of think, that is so easily avoided. That is so easily avoided. It's such a, you know, as you said, try not to be sort of condescending about it or patronising, but really, like, at a certain point, you have to apply a degree of common sense, that's particularly when you're dealing with such sensitive information. It just sort of, at times, it beggars belief, really.
For sure, and sometimes it's boiling it down to, is a safe information handling technique simply telling people to be mindful? Just have a split second to think about what you're doing, because lives are so busy, works are busy, we're all pressured. You could be pressured through work, you could be pressured in your work life, in your home life, you could be trying to run to a meeting. So we've all got these kind of issues going on. We're not robots, we don't operate in a robotic world in that kind of sense. And whether training as simple as just be slightly mindful of what you're doing, take a split second to think. You know what I mean? If you're a couple of minutes late, what is the implications of that going to be compared to dropping really sensitive files, identifying an individual? And sometimes you wonder whether, and it's only my own opinion, I'm more than happy to be challenged on this, and I wonder whether with a lot of data protection training, we're talking about the principles, we're talking about data, we're talking about systems, we're talking about paper, we're talking about electronic and bits and pieces, but when do we actually... And this sounds really, really simple, and I do apologise about that. But when in any trend do we actually turn around to say to people, data protection, we're talking about people, and we're talking about people's private lives. And data protection has got a very human element to it in that sense. And trying to bring the whole lot alive. So it's not just a folder with data, and it should have been on the system, and it shouldn't have been in a memory stick, and so on and so forth. You're talking about carrying around a document that identifies people's lives, people in the personal capacity, that's got their own fears about the world, it's got their own privacy concerns and bits and pieces. And we should be taking appropriate steps from mindfulness as well as anything else to kind of do what we can to, while that information is within our custody, to protect it, and just to be mindful about what you've actually got hold of. It's not just a string of words and letters or numbers on a page. It's actually somebody's life that you're dealing with.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just keeping an eye on the chat. So Leslie's talking about the fact that their policy is effectively that people cannot use printers at home, and if they need to, they have to make a business case effectively, particularly where it might be a health and safety point, which is great if you can enforce it. It's a really good way of doing things. Claire saying that off-site working policies required in education. What I'd be interested in that is how easily that can be policed and enforced, because I think that's where the issue is. When people are at home, how easily actually can you police that? To what degree also do you want to police it? Because at a certain point, you also do want to be able to trust people to carry on with their work in a way which complies with organisational policy.
For sure. I'm interested in the ability to print at home as well, and I'll come on to some of those physical security measures that I've seen recently from our audit and the concerns before we get on to the other topic. But if we allow people to print at home, how do we manage secure destruction of data? Is it meant to be held and returned to the office? Do you permit people to have personal shredders or the provision of personal shredders? And depending on the sensitivity of the documents that they're printing, do you grade the level of shredding? In that sense, so you've got additional security there because you know it's being shredded to a particular grade as opposed to the fact that it's just shredded. And how do we manage that side of things when you're talking about personal documents? I know it more might sound rather a moot point, but as I say, from a physical security audit that I did recently, as a Friday last week, it's the reason why I wasn't on the session last week. It was rather quite shocking at the level of physical security that seemed to be absent from either the boundary or even from the boundary of the building, if that makes sense. So the building itself was secure. It had locks, it had windows. They had a guard to go around at night, make sure things were locked up. But it's the internal security measures, the internal locks to offices, the internal locks to drawers and filing cabinets, paper not being duly located in the right locations and things. And it's wondering how many people actually focus on that level of physical security.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I suppose part of it obviously comes back to training, which is what we're saying, because you can have all of the, as you say, top-notch perimeter boundary sort of security measures in place for your building. But fundamentally, if people aren't trained sufficiently to be able to, recognize and fight tailgating, for instance, and you just wander into the building, which we know from experience is much easier than it should be, just blagging that you're, inspector or something, or an auditor, and just wandering in and having a look around. It doesn't really matter if you've got locks on the windows and a guard going around, as you say, if you can just potter about pretty much undisturbed. And we know because we've seen it.
And just 2 points on that. One that I saw last
Sure.
week was a locked door. Well, several locked doors, several locked offices. And the way into the office was a key that was sat on top of the door frame. In that
Classic.
sense, when it was queried why the key was on top of the door frame and not secured, it was put there so the cleaners could have access to the room, which was just beggars belief in that sense. The other bit as well is sometimes whether you get a false sense of security and whether people kind of think more widely around the security issues. I've certainly been challenged by a CEO that the reception area, well, off the reception area is a staff corridor, and in order to go down the staff corridor, there was one of those PIN codes on the wall, and you had to put a 4 or 5 digit PIN code in there. I was sat there waiting to be escorted to the room to do an audit. This is last year or the year before when I was doing this. And I was just noticing staff just coming freely through the door, both directions. They weren't stopping to put a PIN code in, so therefore the thing was disabled. And at the end of the day, when I was talking to the CEO about it, I said, well, your staff corridor is not secure. And I was challenged, and they said that I need to bear in mind that reception was manned, which it was, but it was only manned by volunteers because it's auditing in that sense. And that the reception area was on CCTV. And the bit about false sense of security is whether people are over reliance on CCTV. Because as I pointed out to the CEO at the time, I could more or less guarantee that the use of CCTV was only passively policed, and you would only actually look if there was ever an issue that was raised that something had happened. If nothing was raised that something had happened, you'd never look at the CCTV video. And therefore, it doesn't. You possibly got a false sense of security around the fact that things will be caught. Because if it's caught and you don't know it's there, then why would you go looking for it?
Yeah, you're spot on. And I mean, that sort of harks back to one of your sort of favorite points in relation to CCTV, doesn't it? Which is that CCTV doesn't address an issue, it just moves it elsewhere. fundamentally. I mean, that's one thing that we've seen plenty of times, particularly obviously we're talking about the housing sector with a large amount of housing stock, and you might put cameras up, but fundamentally it's only going to stop people from, you know, misbehaving in the specific remit of that camera. It's not going to stop them from misbehaving generally. So it's
for sure,
you know, sort of addressing the symptom rather than the root cause of it.
Absolutely. I've seen it with CCTV for trying to prevent fly tipping. And all it does is just move fly tipping to an area where there isn't CCTV. Sure. The individuals that do fly tipping won't suddenly stop just because of CCTV. They'll find a location that hasn't got it.
Yeah. And that sort of weirdly ties in quite nicely with what Claire's saying, which I think sort of relates back to what we were saying about enforcing remote working policies, which is it's more about shifting liability than policing, which is a very good point. I'm also keeping an eye Fareed saying that occasional training is not enough for organizations looking for colleagues to undergo a behavior change. Colleagues need continuous security awareness messaging to develop tangible security skills to apply in their work. And Victoria sort of reiterating that effectively DP equals safeguarding. So I mean, like, yeah, it is fundamentally. I mean, how many times have you seen, Dave, sort of organisations where people get induction training on data protection and then they might get a refresher once a year and it just doesn't stick? I mean, it's not going to. I don't think you can necessarily expect it to stick because it's not sufficient, is it?
They get refresher once a year, and I've certainly seen it in different walks of life, not just with working with DPP, but in other organisations where e-learning is nothing more than somebody turning around saying, can you help me with this because I can't be bothered, in essence, kind of approach. Mm. They're not engaging. E-learning has its place. I don't want to sound like I'm suddenly slating e-learning, not saying it hasn't got its place, but a lot of it is not that engaging. A lot of it's easy to skip through, and a lot of it you can more or less guess the answers and then progress with your day. There's no real kind of thought process. It comes back to the point I've often spoken about when you're delivering training, between whether it's taught, whether it's facilitated, and whether people ought to be doing the thinking as opposed to the facilitator doing the thinking. And that's where it's maybe to help them embed some of the knowledge, is the fact that you give them tasks as opposed to just being taught. So I'm not just going to talk to you for an hour, you go away and go, I'm glad I got through that, I need to do my job. In that sense, if you need to engage the brain, so then they're disengaged from the daily work or whatever they're trying to compete for your attention. They're disengaged from that and then actually start engaging with the material in whatever format that you try to deliver it. So I think it's all very relevant in that sense that we look at training and the quality of training. But some of the e-learning, as you quite rightly say, you get some form of induction training, some form of annual e-learning training, and that is all that get. And generally I've seen, I'm not saying in all cases, but generally I've seen the level of the e-learning that they get cyclical once a year or longer is really rather poor.
Yeah, I tell you what I actually sometimes struggle with when I'm designing and delivering training. And the part of the reason I raise this is because it feeds into another point, which I wanted to get on for today, is that I find it sometimes quite difficult. I know you mentioned previously at the start of the session about how sort of getting across the point that when we're talking about personal data, it's not just, you know, it's not just sort of words on a screen or on a sheet of paper. You know, we're talking about real people and their lives and things associated with them. I sometimes find it quite difficult to sort of get across the importance of some of these things, particularly in terms of compliance from a regulatory perspective, without sort of falling into that sort of scaremongering trap, if you like, of saying, well, if you don't do this, then the ICO are going to come and fine you, which for starters, as we know, is probably pretty unlikely anyway. And this is kind of the point I wanted to get to, is one of our favorite topics for ranting, the ICO's enforcement actions or lack thereof, as the case may be. But obviously, you know, sort of regardless of that, I don't like falling into that trap of trying to scaremonger, because I don't think it's particularly useful. I think it's better to obviously demonstrate data protection laws as something which enables you to process data, and they're important safeguards in place to sort of guarantee safe information handling and, you know, guarantee your rights and freedoms, which is obviously the key maxim of it. But I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, Dave, of sort of finding that balance, I suppose, between, you know, sort of getting that message across without falling into that sort of trap.
Yeah, I think we just got to be careful. I think many moons ago, a lot of people going down the line of where you could be fined, you could be fined. And really, like you say, it's not really transpired that way, has it? Quite frankly, and although there's a range of enforcement actions, it's the regulator's got a lot of tools available to them, but you don't see them exercise that heavily enough in sense for anybody to really sit up and go, all right, I've heard you say it before, but it very, very rarely happens. You've got no evidence to back up what you're kind of saying in that sense. The traction I tend to get better with is actually making it kind of trying to bring data protection to life and talking about people, talking about private lives, and that way we're handling information on individuals, but then relate it to them and get them thinking about their own data, get them thinking about where is their information. And in essence, because we're delivering it to employees, then turning around to saying, well, if you can't think about where your information is, you can't think possibly about what Tesco's, for example, might be processing information or Facebook or so on and so on. Well, just think about the information we hold on you as an employee. So we certainly know your name and address. We certainly know where your salary and your salary bands that you're operating in. We certainly know if you've had health issues and you've been to occupational health, because we get access to those records as well. We certainly know if you've fallen out with members of staff or there's been disagreements, because we're involved in conduct issues and stuff. So if you just think about the information we hold on you as your employer, to a greater or lesser extent, then how would you feel if that information was then left on a photocopier, or is then not protected in the same way as it should be, and so on and so forth? And you try to, I'm not saying it's a perfect approach, but trying to really make it about them before you then start going through the reasons for it. So they kind of get bought into it in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And Peter and Leslie are sort of reiterating that, I suppose, or at least echoing it, of relating it back to them and their area and making it applicable. I say, yeah, just in relation to this, and I suppose it's just a bit of a moan, really. The one thing that really grinds my gears, and I know it gets to you as well, Dave, is when you try and, you know, link it back to someone and say, well, how would you feel if your information got breached? And you get that sort of eye-rolling response of, well, nothing to hide, nothing to fear. I don't care if my information gets breached. You sort of go, right, okay. Well, it's not really the point, is it?
No, for sure. And sometimes it's, I mean, I've had conversations with people around that kind of thing, and it's, if that's their stance, then that's fine. I don't see that necessarily reflective across the greater public arena in that sense. People have got concerns about privacy. People have got concerns about organisations overreaching into the private lives and misusing information and targeting them for all sorts. And it'd be interesting, really, to try and build a kind of a similar. Can you remember a few years ago when they were talking about elections and campaigning, and there was an advert on telly that said, "Oh, I'm not interested in politics," and that kind of thing, is trying to shut down conversation about politics by saying they weren't interested in about it. And then there was a couple of people having conversations, and he goes, "Well, I'm not happy about this with schools," and they somebody then turned around and said, "Well, that's politics. We can't talk about that," and then trying to revert it back that way. So I wonder whether you could possibly do something from a data protection or privacy or intrusiveness or rights point, where you kind of go, no, when somebody's kind of coming out with, "Well, I've got nothing to hide," and you go, "Well, if you've got nothing to hide, well, you won't worry about facial recognition, CCTV cameras, for example, tracking your positions and tracking your location around the City of London and where you're going and what you're doing and so on and so forth and who you're meeting." And when they go, "Well, I'm not happy with that," so, well, you see, you have got issues. You've certainly got some kind of your own privacy concerns, even if you don't want, even if you're not worried about what people see. You know what I mean? And it's sometimes whether we can try to get that kind of engagement and feedback, and kind of trying to get them to see it from our point of view in that sense.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think
One of the big ones, though, without trying to quit, I'm just kind of mindful of the time, and we could talk for hours over this, and I'm sure we could do another section just purely on security, physical security, and so on, and training and bits and pieces around there. But I just wonder whether somebody who says that they've got nothing to hide, and then I don't mind if you say I've got nothing to hide, whether they would be, this is a point, it was one of the bits that came up in the news this morning that I've shared on LinkedIn, and I know we've spoken about it, is Apple's proposed kind of view to assessing photographs for child abuse images and taking measures if they were identified in that sense. Did you read the article, Ollie?
I've not had a chance to read it, but I know we spoke about it, and I've definitely seen the headline, which is, I mean, effectively the idea that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but basically that they're going to automate this process of scanning through your phone in the background, and if they find things related to child abuse, then you're nicked. And obviously that's very interesting. And I think what we were sort of reiterating this morning when we spoke about it is that what's interesting in relation to this specifically is that obviously things like child abuse are very black and white. Mm-hmm. We're all on board with the fact that it's, you know, abhorrent. You know, there's no sort of real grey area for us to go, well, this is something that maybe we need to think about more carefully. It's quite an emotional issue, if anything. We all sort of go, yeah, we need to do everything we can to stop this. But then what happens if maybe it's an issue which is currently, this is a criminal offence, but is a much more of a grey area? You know, maybe, well, I was talking to you this morning potentially about substance abuse, and the fact that obviously can be a criminal offence, but it's viewed in many different ways. Some people like it enforced as a criminal thing. Some people see it as a health problem and a rehabilitation approach. Some people don't have an issue with it at all. So where do you draw the line then? Is it then proportionate on something like that to start rifling through people's phones looking for some sort of evidence or smoking gun? It's where is the line? I think that is the key thing, isn't it, really?
Absolutely. I mean, it is taken away, and you're absolutely right. Let's just move to the side. Child abuse is abhorrent, very emotive, and all the rest of it. So just move that to one side, because that's not kind of the focus that we're looking at here. What we're looking at here is whether there's a worrying development in the use of technology, or whether it's an acceptable use of technology, as kind of the two players to kind of have a bit of a moot point about. So is it worrying in the sense that could it be used to develop in other areas, like say smaller levels or lower levels of crime and criminal activity? Would it be used, for example, could it be used, or would it be progressed if they could identify you through facial recognition, seeing that you've got photographs within your on your phone or pushed to the Apple iCloud, for example, that may have that demonstrates you've got political affiliations one way or another, or that is some form of activism going on, and kind of using it to stifle or hamper kind of political debate or inhibit freedom of speech. In that kind of sense, you've got all this kind of, is that the case, and should technology be used for that point? You've got somebody like Apple that's globally over the world. It's probably got more sight of stuff in essence than most law enforcement agencies because of the technology and bits and pieces around. Or on the other hand, is it an acceptable use to a degree, potentially acceptable use because of some of the areas that we've looked at? However, will it actually achieve what it set out to achieve? Will it actually stop child abuse images being shared, or low levels of crime and bits and pieces, whatever it's being used for? Or will it just move it elsewhere? Very similar to the analogy with CCTV. Is it actually going to solve the issue, or will it move it elsewhere? Will it make the policeable unpoliceable because you're moving it to the dark web, for example?
Yeah, well, that's an extremely good point. And Michael also making one which instantly sort of came to me, which is the false positive aspect. You know, if it's automated and we're relying on machine learning to do this for us, you know, the risk there of someone being picked up by this for something which, as Michael says, is completely harmless, you know, that's a huge risk, because that is an extremely heavy allegation. You know, we're not talking about a bit of graffiti or something. We're talking about something extremely serious, and it's an allegation that can stick with people and ruin people's lives if it's, you know, leveled incorrectly. It's really important to get it right. Victoria making a really good point as well, that machine learning has its biases, which we discussed very briefly this morning.
We did,
Dave. Yeah. Last weekend I sat down to watch the Netflix documentary Coded Bias, which someone had mentioned previously. It's very interesting. Essentially, without sort of, you know, rabbiting on too much, the premise of it being that AI is currently developed by 9 firms, I think, worldwide, something to that effect. Not very many. They're the key players in AI, effectively. And for a variety of reasons, including how it's developed and the people behind it, those algorithms are sometimes being coded with sort of biases, whether it's, you know, gendered bias or whether it's racial bias. In the particular case, the documentary focuses on the fact that facial recognition technology is particularly bad at detecting the faces of women of colour, because traditionally they've been fed pictures of white men. So it's something that you absolutely need to be aware of. And if you're going to apply something which has potential flaws in it like that, which are very serious flaws, to something quite so, as I say, serious, then you've got to make sure that you're getting it absolutely spot on before it's rolled out.
For sure, I agree. I think there's yes, on one hand, you can certainly see there are benefits. Forgetting the privacy implications at the moment, that you could say there are benefits of using technology in an effective way. In that sense, very similar to the internet being designed for the purpose of the internet, then being misused for the purpose that the internet's now misused for, in that kind of sense. So a very similar argument with this, and whether you could use technology to do some good, or whether it's going to be abused, find it's got low control measures, have not considered the privacy implications around that, and so on. And I think it's got to be very, very careful, and I think they've got to have some really strong and safeguards in place for the very reasons that you've just been talking about in relation to machine bias, and also that Michael's mentioned again, false positives. And so on in that sense. And even looking at what Ian's mentioned in the chat, I've just opened up the chat and kind of looking at, well, Apple is at the end of the day a private company and not a public authority. And who oversees Apple or a private company?
Absolutely.
Now, I know being rather cynical, we also spoke about whether, is it, and this is, I'm open to being challenged on this because I realise it could well just be rather a bit of a moot point, but is it actually a drive from Apple to kind of say, well, this is acceptable? Is it kind of like an acceptable use form for the use of Apple products? Or is it Apple actually saying, actually, this is a rather complex matter. It's got quite big business implications to it from associations with such images, if we're looking at child abuse images and that kind of thing. And are they simply thinking, well, if I can drive it from the platform, it becomes less of an issue for us as a company and it just places the issue on somebody else in that sense?
Yes, there's a lot tied into that. And I know we spoke this morning, so we'll come back to it about, I suppose there's a question in there of, at a certain point, A, as Ian quite rightly says, if a private company are doing the policing, then who is policing them? And also B, is it that company's responsibility to be policing their platforms? Which is an entirely different question. Now, Victoria raises in the chat an incident, which, well, not an incident, but I suppose an occurrence which I've been aware of. I know that is a thing that's happened, rather disappointingly. But is it those companies' responsibility to go and make those changes? You know, we talked about this morning whether it's right or wrong for there was an incident like a couple of years ago, wasn't there, where basically Donald Trump got kicked off of Twitter and people are saying, well, it's, you know, limiting his freedom of speech. But is it their responsibility to police that? Obviously they're entitled to if it breaches their acceptable use policies. But is it their position to do it? I don't know. I don't necessarily have the answers. My innate feeling is that yes, it is, because in an ideal world, you could just give people these tools and trust them to behave themselves and use them properly. But we know that's not going to be the case. We know people are going to misbehave, although misbehave puts it lightly. So, yeah, there probably is a responsibility. But it's obviously an extremely complex issue. And as you quite rightly said, at a certain point, you have to think, well, are they doing this out of, you know, the goodness of their hearts, the fact they're really concerned about privacy? Or is it just commercial? And does that matter fundamentally? Because maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe their reasons for making those changes are frankly irrelevant if the changes are positive ones.
For sure, but I think the wider element is it a positive one, or is it just a positive one for them? Because it still comes back to the analogy with CCTV. Are you simply just moving the problem? It's not addressing the problem. Is it just simply moving the problem? So it's not our concern because it's not happening on our doorstep. It's not happening on our platform. We've got no responsibility. We're not going to be held to account for looking like we're accepting particular types of images or commentary and so on and so forth because we police it. And if it is, we put parameters in place in order to make sure it doesn't happen on our platform. So it doesn't necessarily stop individuals behaving in that way. It just means that they're just limited to using Apple products in this sense.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, we mentioned, as you quite rightly said, you know, if you're moving the problem elsewhere, potentially you're making what is a policeable problem unpoliceable, because the grade of technology and of resources now available to the individual consumer, you know, is frankly huge. You know, I mentioned to you this morning that for absolutely no shady reasons, purely security ones, I, you know, pay for a VPN privately and I have access to that. And you only need to think that, you know, if you did want to go up to mischief, it would be so easy to go and do that somewhere where you're not going to be policed at all. You know, you get into spaces where it is literally impossible to do so. And I mean, not only that, but you know, I'm talking in quite extreme terms here, and you mentioned like the dark web, Dave, which obviously is impossible to regulate. But even on some of these social media platforms, which are possible to regulate, the regulation doesn't happen. I said to you this morning that, you know, some time ago, I made the crucial error of delving into the comment section of a post about something quite controversial on Facebook, and in there I found something which was just, I mean, catastrophically racist. Like, I just couldn't believe that someone would say that. So I thought, right, well, I'll report that, because that has no place being there. The machine learning algorithm took a look at it, said, I don't think this is racist, but you can appeal it. So I did, obviously. And then a moderator took a look at it and said, well, it doesn't violate our acceptable use policies, I'm leaving it up. And anyone with even a shred of common sense would have known exactly what the inference was in the content that I'd been reporting. But, you know, they can wash their hands of it, say, well, I don't violate our acceptable use policies, nothing to do with us, you know, on you go. So it's not even a question of the technology enabling it, I suppose.
Well, no, absolutely. In that sense, you're looking at who sets a standard behind a technology that enables it, and who polices those standards, who sets what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable that the software has got to comply with. In that sense, I think you're absolutely right. In that instance, just running that example, if you challenged it as you did, and you took it to a review process, and you said that you feel that in essence, the computer is wrong in its determination, and it needs a human intervention to have a look, and that that individual looked, and that individual said, "Well, actually, I don't feel it infringes our acceptable use. To us, it's quite acceptable. Those comments aren't as derogatory as you believe," in that kind of sense. If that was a decision of, say, somebody from the far right, for example, then that doesn't make it acceptable, just because you're trying to achieve a standard that's their standard, not necessarily the accepted.
No, it's incredibly difficult. Although, Victoria does make a good point. You know, we're talking about the fear of it moving elsewhere, saying that, you know, that shouldn't stop us from trying. And you're absolutely right. You know, it's not good enough to just say, well, if we try and fight it, it's only going to get worse. I don't think the right option is to just let it sort of
burn itself out,
because that's not going to work, is it?
No, I think it's a very valid point, but there's a difference between doing something and moving the problem to a point where you can't police it. So it's not necessarily a case of doing nothing, but is it more manageable where it is and more policed where it is than moving it somewhere where there's less policing, less parameters, harder to find, and still not addressing the problem? So it's that kind of, and it's a moot point, I get, in that sense. But should we necessarily drive from an area where we know it's happening and an area where we know we can police it through laws or international laws, if we're talking about multinational international companies? Should we ensure that, yes, we're trying to address it, but we want to try to address it in a platform where we know it's happening and in a platform where we can take action, as opposed to moving outside of that platform and kind of making it, well, we know it's happening, but it's a bit of a needle in a haystack. We're not quite sure which field the haystack's in.
Yeah, for sure. And obviously the complication in all of this is that, you know, 90% of the time these issues are going to be tied into, as we've mentioned, very emotional, emotive problems, things that elicit a very strong response from people, things that are very polarizing. And that in and of itself has sort of implications. I'll tell you what, this is, I don't know if you had any other points to make on this, but if not, there's something I was going to tie into this. Which is that point of, I feel that all too often people sort of lose sight of what the law actually says and does, because they get caught up in these emotive issues. I don't know if that's something you come across a lot, Dave, but obviously it's not something that you're leveling at people, really. You know, it's completely understandable that if you're in the midst of, I mean, sometimes it can be something as quote unquote trivial as a neighbor dispute. But if you've ever had, you know, difficulties with your neighbours, you know how quickly things can spiral.
Mm-hmm.
But in the context of that, I find a lot of the time I see instances where too easily people get caught up in the circumstances, in the context of whether it's, I don't know, a DSAR or a breach or something. And as a result, that context starts to leak into their interpretation of the law in a way which is possibly not helpful. Now, obviously, you can't decontextualize issues, and context is obviously important, but sometimes I feel that may go too far. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, if that's something you've seen.
Yeah, I've certainly seen elements of where the law is given an interpretation that suits their purpose. in that sense. It's not necessarily the right interpretation of the law, but it suits individual's purpose. On a very basic sense of that, one of my clients recently went through an employment process, told an individual, in essence, that you weren't successful. Thanks for trying, but not on this occasion. Maybe a bit friendlier than that, but that is in essence what happened. The individual wrote back to them and said, right, delete all of my information now. In that sense, the client came back to me and asked, well, what do we do with this? And I said, well, just explain the fact that we've retention periods and then enable you to hold on to information for particular periods of time. And for applicants that weren't successful, for a job applicant that wasn't successful, that you can retain that information for around about 6 months, just in order to ensure that the process was fair to all applicants and so on, as demonstrated by the CIPD and things like this. And the individual came back and says, that's not what the law says. The law says you delete it on the owner's request, delete it immediately.
Mm.
And it's they've got a justifiable stance, because it's something, I'm not talking at a job applicant from months ago, it is a very recent process and a very recent turn down of somebody, to the fact that the if you were going to hold on to the information for 6 months in order to demonstrate that the process was fair, should the process be challenged and so on and so forth, the end of the retention period is going to be February 2022. So we're still well within the ability to retain that information in that sense. But the data subject themselves had interpreted, erasure means when I tell you to delete it, you will delete it. Now go away and delete it. That kind of approach. I'll show you the email offline on. But yeah, in essence, no, that's what she said. And again, we just had to go back and reiterate to them, actually, their approach to data retention and their approach to retaining information was compliant with both the GDPR and also guided by CIPD in relation to non-successful job applicants. And therefore, with the information will be retained to demonstrate that the process was fair, and the period of 6 months is chosen, as the CIPD clearly indicate, because there's varying different time parameters around discriminatory laws and things, and therefore the information will be held for that period. And we quite clearly indicated at the end that your information will be deleted securely on a particular date in February 2022, at which point of the 6 months had expired and it will be securely deleted. But that's just an example of where individuals have just tried to interpret the law for their own, to meet their own needs, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Victoria making an excellent point, which is I sort of tied into this potentially misunderstanding the actual wording of the law and how it works, and the fact that most people, or a lot of people anyway, completely misunderstand still to this day the idea that consent is always needed. And I tell you what, I try and find the article, and I have to say, I'm not normally down on, you know, sort of ripping on people or being down on them generally, but I read a piece on the BBC the other week. It was about the Amazon fine, actually, which we probably should have mentioned, but the Amazon fine, which is absolutely colossal. This piece had been written on the BBC News website, and I'm sorry, but it was catastrophically misinformed. It was really, really poor. It was saying things like the GDPR has come in, so we still need to get you now need to get consent for processing. No, you don't. We know that's not the case. And they were just endless. Like, this article, honestly, I'll have to try and dig it out, but just constantly reiterating things which were wrong, incorrect. And, you know, as Mark's saying, poor journalism playing a big part. That's what I'm getting at, is that the journalism was just an incredibly poor standard, barely researched. And I suppose at a certain point, you can't really blame people if, you know, they're getting their information and it's absolutely wrong in the first place.
For sure, for sure.
I'll have to... Victoria saying that DfE stated yesterday that consent was needed to retain data. Well, there you go. That's all you need to know. I'll have to see if I can dig out that article just for everyone's benefit, because it sort of both gave me a laugh and frustrated me, I suppose. Speaking of which, I don't know if you had anything to contribute more on that sort of point, Dave, but if not, there was one I did want to talk about quickly, is that I've seen today that last week, I think, more or less, the ICO published a response to a Daily Telegraph story about their work and impact and their priorities. I don't know if you saw this. It's on the ICO website, and it's sort of one of their news items. I don't know if you come across it, Dave.
I haven't seen that one, no.
No, and I have to say that this response from the ICO feels incredibly, what's the word, maybe meek. It's very sort of, well, in line with their enforcement, I suppose, toothless. I can pop the link in the chat, but some of it where they're sort of trying to respond to some of these claims and talking about the fact that, no, they don't chase headlines with fines and actually they're fined X amount under PECA, it just comes off a little bit sad, if anything. You know, talking about the fact that they've, you know, they say here almost with a sense of pride, well, actually, since April 2015, we've dished out £13.5 million worth of PECA fines. But that's about 5 PECA fines a year if you're fining the maximum amount. Like, that's not, sorry, that's not that much though, is it? Like, let's be honest. It just sort of like feeds into this general sort of vibe of the ICO just being a bit toothless. And I guess
they've certainly got
what we were saying.
Yeah, they've certainly got teeth, but they've certainly got teeth and some powers under the GDPR, but it's like they're wearing a gum shield. In that sense, it's like it looks like they're fearing using them. They've certainly got powers that they could be used, and I don't know whether it's because they kind of lead with the carrot and the stick approach, where they kind of encourage and that kind of help and support and guide through. But they could certainly use the teeth a little bit more. And I'm not always an advocate heavily of going down the fine route every time, but I've certainly had breaches with clients or experienced breaches with clients where things are reported to the ICO, and the ICO looks at it and then goes, "Well, we're not really taking any more action. We're kind of putting it to bed, not really." Really worrying about it in that sense. We've seen your action plan, fine. That kind of approach from the ICO. And what I'd like to possibly see sometimes from the ICO is saying, possibly if it's the right context, taking something similar along that line, but then saying, well, actually, yes, we've looked at it. We're not taking any further action. We agree with your action plan that you've got, but we want to see evidence that you've completed your action plan within 6 months. Put something a little bit onerous around it. Put some follow-up on it, because if they come back and kind of say, in essence, well, that's fine, we've seen your action plan, we're not going to take any further action, where is the onus to actually complete your action plan? Where is it? You know what I mean? Does that put responsibility back on them, saying, right, fair enough, if you've got a really spot action plan, demonstrate that you've complied with it and demonstrate that you complete your actions within a defined period of time. And if you haven't, then we'll come back and we'll have another look at you. Just try to get, because we spend a lot of time saying that you've got to be careful because of the regulators, be careful because of X, Y, and Z, and you're infringing the law. But if the law's never challenged and the law's never kind of enforced, then are we not just blowing a lot of hot air around, quite frankly? And I'd like to say that the ICO would just take a little bit more, not necessarily, like I say, always down the side of enforcement, but could they not take additional steps? Could they not kind of follow up on actions and so on in order to, as a lot of the hot air is actually quite relative and it's not just hot air in that sense?
Yeah, and I think, to be honest, the part of the issue, at least insofar as, you know, my experience of it, and I'm happy to be challenged on this, of course, but part of the issue is I do find... And I've not actually read the piece in the Telegraph, by the way, so I'm sort of going in blind here. But if they are criticising the ICO's priorities and enforcement, I can't help but agree instinctively, because sometimes I'm frankly baffled by the approach they take to things. So I've been involved in instances where, you know, on behalf of a client, we've had to report a breach, and I'm sort of saying to the client, you know, this doesn't look good. This is not a good look for you. You know, you've not done as you should have done, and you might be getting in quite, you know, severe trouble here. You're going to land yourself in hot water. And the ICO come back and they're just not, like, really not interested. And I'm sort of like, well, but then on the flip side of that, we had that charity the other week that were fined, what, like 3% of their global turnover? Some, like, tiny charity I'd never even heard of that I think supports trans people. And they're going to go and sting them and take them, you know, for 3% of their global turnover. I know that you can't sort of decide to lead your enforcement based on, you know, what sort of organisations you might like or might not like and the work that they're doing, that shouldn't come into it. But you can't help but feel that sometimes they've not really got it right. I don't know, maybe I'm being unfair.
I would agree. Like I said, they've certainly got teeth, but they tend to come out trying to look like they've got the capabilities of punching their way out of a wet paper bag. And I think they should use different measures to help enforce compliance, to help demonstrate that actually you need to take it seriously. Because if the regulator doesn't take it seriously, why should we, in that essence? And I certainly think they've got the means to do that. And it would be certainly nice to see them demonstrating that. And I think personally, from the ICO's point, instead of Coming out and giving some watered down version potentially of an article that was published in The Guardian, then she should maybe take on board what The Guardian is saying. She should maybe take on board what the European Parliament said about their enforcement activity when you go into the adequacy debate, and actually think, is this now the time that we actually start taking it a little bit more seriously and demonstrating not just the big fines, not just the news grabbers and things, but should we now start focusing on our own compliance and our own enforcement?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And I think actually you touch on something there, which is, I think, probably relevant to all of this, that sometimes I really feel like the ICO doesn't take on board, as you say, that criticism, and instantly it's adversarial. Instantly it's, oh, well, actually, you know, we are busy. We're doing these things, X, Y, and Z. And it's like, well, hang on a second. Just listen to what we're saying. You've got privacy professionals and DPOs up and down the country, and now, you know, broadsheet newspapers and, as you mentioned, the European Parliament saying to you that you're not doing enough. Take that on board. You know, think about it. Mark making a good point saying that potentially we might have a new approach from November, which is the change in ICO, right? Or IC, I guess, Information Commissioner. I don't know if it's actually been confirmed that that guy that was being touted, the guy
John
from New Zealand,
yeah,
going to take over that. I don't know if that's actually been confirmed yet, but it'd be interesting to see if we did get a different approach, for sure. My suspicion is that we will get a different approach, but not in this sense. I'm maybe being a pessimist, unfairly so, but I only see the enforcement getting more lax, particularly considering the statements that we've had out of the UK government. We've mentioned this a couple of times now, a statement from Oliver Dowden on, you know, being able to move away from the European standard and sort of set our own rules. And also someone, I forget, maybe a government department the other week, saying that they wanted to start monetizing our data.
Well,
we might be able to become a data haven even.
Yeah, you might be a pessimist, Ollie, and I'm probably too much of a cynic, which is maybe why we get on. But I would have honestly thought if they're looking for a new information commissioner and the direction of the government to be a data haven, they'd find somebody that's more in tune with their thinking as opposed to somebody that's going to battle them all the way. But that's the cynic in me, as opposed to the pessimist in you.
Well, yeah, quite possibly. And I think we briefly spoke about this last week with Jasmine and Tara. It was raised that China putting forward their new sort of privacy bill, and that's on the table. Although, obviously, as we said at the time, China's record on privacy issues probably isn't the best. But considering sort of, you know, the options available to us post-Brexit in terms of trade, it's pretty conceivable that we might start to cuddle up to America and China more, countries that have poor track records with privacy, and that our standards might start to slide along with theirs. Maybe that's not fair, maybe it's not relevant, but I can't help but make that association, quite frankly.
Well, let's put a pause on that. We've nearly hit the 1:30, and I really need to
you
jump.
Need to get off.
Let's also maybe consider this in about 12 months' time, once we've got a new commissioner, once we see our things settle, and see who's right. Is it the pessimist or the cynic, or will things actually change? In fact, that's possibly the title for the one next year. Is it the pessimist or the cynic?
Yeah, exactly. So on that note, I'll see you this time next year then. No, but you're right. We do need to bring this to a close. If you need to go off, Tave, do get yourself off while we wrap up. This one obviously quite informal this week, as these sessions are, the GDPR radios. But hopefully, all of that was at least in some way interesting and helpful, and it's always a good opportunity, as I say, to sort of have a bit of a chat and kick these things around. If there's anything that anyone on the session wanted to cover and we haven't gotten to, I know we mentioned the Amazon fine like extremely briefly, we will be back same time next week with another session, so we can always pick it up then. Or obviously, if you want to contact us about anything in the meantime, you can get in touch with us, support@dataprotectionpeople.com. Send anything in and we can take a look at that. But as I say, if you've got any questions, we'll definitely be back to answer them. I don't know what the session is next week, Miles. Actually, I do know what the session is next week. I'd tell a lie. It's our big SARS and FOIA session, isn't it? That's the headline next week, Miles.
That's right, Ollie. Yeah, we've got Foya and SARS. That's on the 11th of August. It's actually, we're holding it on a Wednesday instead of a Friday, just because we've got a lot of people who miss out on our sessions week in, week out. And Wednesday was the day when the most people could attend. So we'll be hosting that 12:30 till 1:30 on Wednesday the 11th.
Yeah, so I've told a slight fib there, so I do apologise. But yeah, so we'll be back at that time. As I say, and please do send in anything that you'd like us to look at in the meantime. Really hope to see you on that one. It's shaping up to be an excellent session. Obviously, SARS is always a popular topic. So yeah, we'll hope to see you then. But otherwise, yeah, thank you for joining. I'm thanking Dave, even though he's gotten off, but thanking him for his contribution. Thanking everyone for their contributions in the chat. It's always great. And as I say, thank you all for attending. Hope to see you next week. Take care till then.